Meeting to order at 1:35. All members are present except one, and he's on his way. And we're happy to have with us today Senator Dyson, Senator Calgary, Senator Elton, and Senator Thomas will be joining us. We have one bill to take up today. And that is SJR number one. And Richard Benavides, which I always want to mess up his last name, Benavides, will do the orientation of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Richard Benavides, staff to Senator Davis, who was the sponsor for SJR 1. And SJR 1, which is Medical Assistance for Children, basically states that the Alaska State Legislature is urging our congressional delegation to work diligently to achieve a timely reauthorization of the state Children's Health Insurance Program and to continue federal medical assistance percentages, or FMAP, for the Denali Kid Care Program. Denali Kid Care is Alaska's version of the state's Children's Health Insurance Program, or SCHIP, which was created in 1997 and is slated for reauthorization this year. It has been and continues to be a successful federal-state partnership, now covering over 4 million low-income children and enjoying bipartisan support. However, in the upcoming fiscal year, 17 to 18 states, among them Alaska, are projected to have insufficient federal SCHIP funding to sustain their existing SCHIP programs. According to various estimates by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Congressional Research Service, and other independent analysts, these states will face an estimated $800 to $950 million in total funding shortfalls in 2007. Here in Alaska, that shortfall could total over $12 million. Without additional federal funding to avert these shortfalls, Alaska, along with other states, may have to reduce their SCHIP enrollment, placing health insurance coverage nationally for over 500,000 low-income children at risk. States may also be forced to enact changes to their SCHIP programs, such as curtailing benefits, increasing beneficiary cost sharing, or reducing provider payments. Congress has acted in the past to address these shortfalls successfully and can do so again. To that end, just this last Friday, February 23rd, a bipartisan group of lawmakers announced that their proposal to extend health insurance to an additional 9 million children in the U.S., backed by a broad consumer and industry coalition, the Healthy Kids Act of 2007 would authorize over $50 billion over 5 years to expand SCHIP and Medicaid programs. The proposal would also provide $10 billion for refundable tax credits to help families with annual incomes of up to 350% of the federal poverty level to purchase health insurance that covers children if they're not eligible for their state's SCHIP program. We ask your support of SJR 1 to add the Alaska State Legislature to the many voices urging our delegation and the rest of Congress to enact legislation immediately that provides additional funding to ensure that all states has sufficient federal funding to sustain their existing SCHIP programs in fiscal year 2007. And also to that end, I just read this morning that the National Governors Association had a special meeting just yesterday with the White House on this very program, and there's also going to be a roundtable discussion in Washington, D.C. with the National Governors Conference and the Cabinet Chair of HHS, specifically again on the SCHIP program. So it's a program that is quite high on the list of priorities for all the governors in the United States. And with that, I'll...
Thank you very much for that overview. And I want to acknowledge that Senator Thomas is with us now. We do have some people that are signed up to testify, I think. And we're going to call the Commissioner of Health and Social Services to come up. Carlene Johnson, Jackson.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
For the record, Carlene Jackson, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, and I want to thank the committee for sponsoring this resolution. And I also wanted to add that our governor did meet with Secretary Leavitt, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I believe this morning, and this was one of the issues that she stressed with him. I also did meet with Senator Murkowski late last week when she was in Juneau, and she expressed her support as well for this issue. So again, I just wanted to speak to thank the committee for your work on this.
Thank you very much.
And I'll answer any questions you might have.
Committee members, are there any questions? Senator Elton?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
For either Richard or for the commissioner, we have kind of a two-pronged problem. One is the shortfall in 2007, and the other is continued funding out into the future, including the February 23rd effort that is in the sponsor statement. The resolution doesn't talk to the shortfall. I mean, should it, or is that a separate issue?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, officially it's a separate issue. However, the bipartisan bill that was introduced is specifically intended to cover both the shortfall and forward funding for this year and hopefully the way it's drafted the next 5 years. So at the very least, in the past, they have at least funded the shortfalls. Generally, the shortfalls come from the surpluses from the other states, but it all depends on how much of a surplus comes from the other states, and I believe Commissioner Jackson could probably speak better to that.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, as I understand it, the redistribution issue is also being talked about with Secretary Leavitt and others in Congress. So the reauthorization is one piece, and then the fact that states like Alaska that have done a really good job in getting kids enrolled in Denali Kid Care shouldn't be penalized by that as other states begin to also do a good job. So they're asking for more money to be added to the pot as well as the reauthorization to take place, as I understand it.
So if I could follow up. So it doesn't.
Yes, you may.
So we don't need to worry about adding a whereas or a resolve that speaks to the shortfall. We're covering all bases by encouraging funding out into the future.
May I speak to that after you finish?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Senator Elton, I was going to say I really can't speak to that issue because this is your resolution. I can only report on what I know is happening out there. Thank you.
Thanks.
The resolutions that's before you is strictly for the reauthorization. First of all, if there's no reauthorization, there will be no money. That's including the shortfall and the money that we're getting now. And I'm sure that it will be reauthorized, but I think that we should encourage them to do that. And I would prefer that this resolution just stick to the basics, reauthorize it. And any reauthorization that comes up usually bring new money or more money with it.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
Ma'am.
Yes.
I noticed this, most of this money is expected to come from federal funds. Is that right? And is there any consideration of the state general funds funding any of this, or perhaps the permanent fund earnings account puts some money in the basket for it too?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I believe at this the way we do things at this point is that money comes from GF unless you specifically as a legislature authorize that money to come from someplace else.
And through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I really didn't bring all the breakdown on SCHIP and was only speaking to the reauthorization at this point in time, but we can certainly find more information for you should you want it.
Well, just as a comment, I think, you know, we've got a lot of money in the permanent fund earnings account, reserve account, and I think personally you couldn't find a better place to spend it than maybe for this, and it'd be a start. I know everybody's kind of leery of even mentioning spending any part of that, but anyway, I'd like to get it done.
Thanks for the comment. At this point, we're going to stick to the reauthorizations, which is the federal funds part. We do at some point later have to address what additional funding will come from the state and where that money will come from at a later time. I have no one else signed up to testify to this resolution, and I would like to close testimony on it unless there is someone from the audience that want to speak to it that hasn't signed up. What will be the will of the body for the SJR? I'm sorry?
Yeah, just for the record, I want to state that I believe one of my extended family members received funds from this, and several of my foster kids have in the past. I don't believe I have a conflict of interest.
No, I don't think so. It is my intention to move this piece of legislation out of committee. What's the will of the body?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'd move SJR number one with the attached fiscal note and ask for unanimous consent.
It has been moved and asked for unanimous consent on SJR one. Is everybody acceptable to that? There would be no need for a roll call. Thank you very much. We do have to sign that bill, but before we get around to that, I just want to ask the presenters to come up that's going to talk to us this afternoon. We do have presenters that's coming here speaking in behalf of Investing in Alaskan's Children, and there's at least four people that's, or is it just the two of you?
No, we have several, yes. I think there are six in total.
Would you like to give the order of the way you're going to present?
Sure. My name is Carol Prentice, and I will be moderating and speaking briefly. Jim Calvin will be the next speaking.
Okay.
And Abby Hensley will be the next speaker, followed by Joy Lyon. The next two speakers will be Debbie Baldwin and Annie Shade. And finally, the final speaker is Tiffany Ryan.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to thank Senator Davis and her office and the committee for the opportunity to present this information to you this afternoon. We're really appreciative of the opportunity to present the economic impact report on the early care and learning workforce to you. And in addition, we have a panel, the people I just mentioned, who will be going into more specific detail about some of the issues that are raised. As I mentioned, my name is Carol Prentice, and I'm the project manager for SEED, which stands for the System for Early Education Development. SEED's primary mission is the professional development aspect of the early care and learning workforce, which is appropriate since we're based at the University of Alaska Southeast. I just gave briefly the order, but we'll have Jim Calvin, who's a partner with the McDowell Group, giving a presentation on the economic impact summary, which hopefully you all have copies of here. And then from that point, we'll be happy to take questions, or he'll be happy to take questions. And then we'd like to have the panel of speakers, each of whom will be speaking, addressing a particular issue of early care and learning and family support through the time given in our presentation. So briefly, I'd just like to say that the SEED Council, which is a group of stakeholders of about 25 people throughout Alaska, we're in our final year of funding for SEED, and this group got together and thought, what could we do that would make a really lasting impression on the situation for young children in the state of Alaska? And we determined to do this economic impact report and commissioned the McDowell Group to do that. And I just wanted to share with you that our thinking behind that is that good policy comes from good data. And in Alaska, we've had a real shortage of good data on this particular area of the early childhood workforce and sector and the impact that has on the economy and families of Alaska. So having said that, I will turn this over to Jim Calvin from the McDowell Group.
Thanks, Carol. For the record, my name is Jim Calvin. I'm a partner with the McDowell Group. McDowell Group is a research and consulting firm that's been in business for 35 years now. We have offices in Anchorage, Juneau, and Kodiak. In our 35 years, we've conducted some 1,500 research and consulting assignments for 300 public and private sector clients throughout Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, and Canada. We've studied the economic impact of every key industry in Alaska in our history, including the oil industry on several occasions, seafood processing, commercial fishing, the tourism industry, the cruise ship industry, mining, the timber industry, even the arts industry. This effort to study the economic impact of the child care sector is certainly our first endeavor of this type, and so far as we're aware, the first ever in Alaska. We'll hope that our projector cooperates. There's a male adapter that's not communicating well with a female adapter in our wiring here, so imagine that. They're not communicating too well. Anyway, there's some basic introductory stuff here that I'll move through relatively quickly and get to the economic impact study. Today I'll talk, first of all, we need to define what we're talking about when we talk about the early learning and child care sector. Talk a little bit about some of the longer-term economic and socioeconomic benefits from quality early learning and child care services. Give you some particular survey results, which I think you'll find quite interesting as part of our research effort. We did a telephone survey of 700 Alaska households, and then I think Carol will follow with some next steps to talk about. Again, this is an economic assessment of early education and child care sector in Alaska's economy, and this is just that sector of child care for children under 6 years of age. It doesn't include after-school programs for older children. It doesn't include summer camps, sport camps of that type that many of us have sent our children to in the summer. So it's just the traditional under six early learning child care setting. Our assessment focuses on some of the usual metrics we use to measure economic impact, including employment and income from jobs in this sector of our economy. We also look at how much households are spending on child care services, how much government is spending on child care services. And what's a little bit different about this particular study is the role that the availability of these kinds of services play in making it possible for Alaskans to join the labor force and therefore add income to Alaska families. First, let's talk about some demographics that helps us get our arms around this segment of our economy, this segment of our population. There's just under 63,000 children in Alaska under 6 years of age. This is actually 2005 data, so there's a bit more than that now. 39,400, or about two-thirds of these children, reside in households where all available caregivers are in the labor force. If it's a two-parent household, both parents are working. If it's a single-parent household, that parent is working. These children, these 39,000-plus children, reside in 29,400 households. Obviously, there are some households with more than one child under six. All said and done, about one in eight Alaska households has a child under 6 years of age in a child care setting of some sort. I should add that this piece of our population, this demographic of our population, is growing at a faster rate than the population overall. Growth in the most recent year is about 1.7% for children under 6 years of age compared to the population overall, which has been growing at about 1%. So where do these children reside in terms of the type of household? About two-thirds live in households where both parents are in the labor force. Just slightly under a quarter live in households with a single mother who is in the labor force, and about 12% reside with a single father who is in the labor force. So let's talk for a minute about what the availability of child care services means for Alaska family income. As I said, we have 39,400 children under six residing in 29,000 households in Alaska. That means that there's 29,400 Alaskan householders who are able to join the labor force because they have access to some form of child care service. It may be in their home, in someone else's home, it may be in a center, it may be a Head Start program, but they're able to join the labor force because of the availability of some type of child care service. 29,400 Alaskans represents just under 10% of our labor force. Now, we don't know the particular earnings characteristics of this population in particular, but if we use some general economy-wide averages, it suggests that these 29,400 Alaskans earn roughly $850 million, or about $28,000 per household. Now, the typical Alaska family, urban, rural alike, the typical family earns about $72,000 a year. So this additional income that is made possible by the availability of child care services is a pretty significant piece of family income in Alaska, and has very obvious implications on the standard of living for Alaska families. So talk about some of the more traditional forms of economic impact for this particular sector of our economy. Adding up all of the jobs that we can point to that are in some way either directly or indirectly related to providing child care services in Alaska for children under six. Again, it's just that segment of our population. We can point to about 7,400 jobs in Alaska. And these jobs account for about $124 million in annual payroll. The direct employment impact is about 6,500. That's the number of people that are actually employed in providing care to children under six, about 6,500 workers, and they earn about $94 million in annual payroll. So this isn't, the 6,500 direct jobs is not a giant piece of our employment pie in Alaska. We have roughly 400,000 jobs in the Alaska economy. So the child care sector is not, and the oil industry, it's not commercial fishing, it's not tourism, but it's still a pretty critical piece of our infrastructure, if you want to look at it that way. And it compares rather favorably with some other key parts of our economic infrastructure, if you will. For example, there are 6,400 people employed in the air transportation sector in Alaska's economy. There's 6,000 people employed in residential and non-residential construction. So while it's only about 1.5% of the total employment in Alaska, it's still, you know, relative to other critical industries, it compares quite favorably. I guess that's the good news, if you want to characterize it as such. The not quite as good a news is the wages that are paid in this part of our economy. The typical full-time employee in the child care sector, and there are not a lot of full-time employees, there are many, many part-time workers, but the typical full-time worker will earn less than $21,000 a year in providing care for these children. That's compares to about $26,000 for the typical preschool teacher and $51,000 for the typical kindergarten teacher in our public school system. The average wage all across the Alaska economy, in all sectors of the economy, all industries, is about $38,000. So what this tells us is that the people to which we entrust the early education and care of our youngest children are being paid about half of what the typical job in the Alaska economy earns. Talk for a minute about some broader social or socioeconomic benefits. Now, the numbers that we have here are not from any Alaska-specific research. This is information that we found by doing some nationwide literature searches that focused on what some of the benefits are to society overall from the availability of quality early learning, quality child care programs for children under 6 years of age. Some examples of what we found is that children in quality programs had a 29% higher graduation rate, higher high school graduation rate, 20% higher college attendance rates, and over their lifetime typically would be expected to earn more as a result of better success in education, $143,000 more in terms of income as a result of this early education, this early learning experience. Similarly, children that were exposed to quality early learning, quality early care programs had a 70% lower crime incident rate later in life, 20% lower welfare dependence rates later in life. Now again, this is national research, nothing that's specific to Alaska here, and some of the programs that generated these kinds of findings were fairly intensive, some even in-home programs. But still, I think there's an important message here about what some of the potential benefits are for society in terms of socioeconomic impacts from the availability of quality early learning, quality child care programs. As I indicated earlier, we did a survey of Alaska households. Now, the purpose of this telephone survey was primarily to generate data for us supporting the economic impact analysis in terms of how many households have children in various care settings, how extensively they use various forms of care, how much they pay, et cetera, et cetera. But we also took the opportunity to ask some questions about people's perception about the importance of state government financial support of early learning and child care programs, and I think you'll find those results very interesting. As we would all anticipate, there's pretty significant differences between urban Alaska and rural Alaska in terms of the availability and cost and quality of child care services, so we kind of sliced up the data in three different subgroups. One is urban Alaska, which we defined as any community over 8,000 people. We have a rural one definition, which is communities from 2,000 to 8,000, and rural two, which is the smallest of Alaska's communities, any area under 2,000 people. So we have data sliced according to some geographic characteristics as well. The survey generated a really strong sample for us in terms of the number of households with children in child care settings. In fact, 58% of the households, 58% of the children in households now in child care settings had children in care settings at this point. So it's a good strong sample size. Kind of a detailed table, hard to pick out the real key points on this, but this is what Alaska households are now using in terms of child care opportunities. As you might expect, the preschool or child care centers are a real important source of child care for Alaska households. Half of all of the households that we talked to had their child in some form of preschool or child care setting. I think what's also maybe interesting about this table is on the rural two column. Again, this is the smallest communities in Alaska. The Head Start program is really a key source of in fact, in many places, the only source of child care services. So lots of detail like this on small rural, medium-sized rural, and large urban areas in terms of the kinds of child care services folks are using, the cost of those services, et cetera. And we've got lots of detail in our report if you have some interest in this level of detail. We asked folks that had children in child care setting of some form whether they found it difficult or easy to secure adequate, acceptable child care services, and that was split kind of down the middle. 49% found it easy to find acceptable child care, 45% found it difficult. There was a small fraction that didn't have an opinion one way or another on that. This was probably one of the most profound findings of the survey. Of those households with children under 6 years of age, 36% reported that either the cost, quality, or availability of child care services was in some way preventing them from either joining the labor force at all or working as many hours as they would like to. So that's one in three Alaska households report that they're constrained in some way in their ability to work as much as they would like by either the cost, quality, or availability of child care services. The top issue we asked folks, tell us what's the primary reason. Is it cost? Is it availability? Is it quality? What's keeping you from working as much as you would like? And across the state, cost was the number one issue. In fact, for half of all of these households that said that they were constrained in some way, cost was the number one issue. For about a quarter, quality was the issue. For another quarter, availability was the issue. This is the statewide picture. If you look just at the rural component of our sample, it's a different picture. For those folks, availability was the number one reason for about half of the households that had expressed some frustration with their ability to work due to the lack of appropriate child care, and cost was only about a quarter of the issue. So in rural Alaska, it's more about availability, less about cost. In urban Alaska, it's more about cost, less about availability. And the issue of quality is more of an urban issue as well. Survey data, as well as some other data, secondary data, suggests that the typical monthly cost for care for a child under six ranges between $400 and $900 a month. depending on where in the state you are and the age of the child, gives you a sense of what the costs are faced by households with two children under 6 years of age. So clearly a big impact on family budgets, yet just one in seven Alaska households with a child under six in child care services received some sort of financial aid to support them in their effort to secure child care services.
Does it cost more for infants, or, you know, down to 1 year?
Yes, the short answer is yes.
Than it does, say, the 5 or 6 year old?
That's correct. Here's some other very, very interesting study results. We asked folks, not just householders with young children or householders with children in care settings, but everyone, whether they thought it was important or very important for state government to provide some form of financial support for early education and child care services in Alaska. And overwhelmingly, people said, yes, it's important or very important. Almost 9 out of 10, 87%. Said that it's important or very important. In fact, the very important percentage is about 56%. I think it's very important for state government to provide financial support for early education. Even the households without young children, 86% said it's important or very important for state government to provide some financial support for early learning, early education, and child care services. We also asked householders to prioritize, if you will, the importance of state support for child care services. We asked folks whether they thought it should be a high priority, a medium priority, or a low priority for state government to provide financial support for early education and child care. And 66% said it's a high priority. It should be a high priority for state government. Only K through 12 education was given the high priority by more households at 88%. Early learning came in just ahead of university education, and the number of households suggesting it ought to have a high priority. University education at 57%. We've asked this kind of question on many, many different occasions in our survey research over the years, and invariably K through 12 education comes out as the top priority for Alaska households for state funding among a broad range of typical government services, and university education typically comes out very high in our ranking as well. This was the first time that we'd ever asked about early learning and child care, so it's quite interesting to see how they kind of stack up here relative to K through 12 education and university education. Here's a look at the revenue picture, the spending picture, if you will, on the child care. In the child care industry, we estimated that Alaska households spend about $150 million a year on child care services. The federal government pitches in about $75 million for services and programs related to child care services. State government pitches in about $13 million. All told, there's about $238 million spent in Alaska on either on securing child care services or in providing these services. Here's a little bit more detail. As I said, $150 million from Alaska households. That's out of the back pockets of Alaska families, about $150 million. Slicing up the state's $13.3 million, roughly half goes to the Head Start program, $6.3 million into Head Start, and $7 million into the HSS Child Care Program Office. On the federal side, roughly $75 million. About $38 million of that is to the HSS Child Care Program Office, $28 million to Head Start, and $9 million to and through tribal organizations across the state. Out of the total of $238 million that is spent by families or by governments on child care services, about $226 is actually spent with providers. So there's not much of an administrative overhead in this spending picture. And I think that's where I'll conclude. This is outside of the scope of our work. I know that Carol and others have examined just how Alaska stacks up relative to other states in terms of availability of state-funded programs. Carol, you want to tackle this one?
Sure. Really, it's just a visual to show that When you look at the country as a whole, Alaska is only one of 10 states without a state-funded statewide early childhood education system. Rhode Island was the last. It used to be 11. We had to update our information because Rhode Island recently adopted an early care and education system. Some of the current initiatives, I'm not going to go over these because that's what the panel will be doing in just a few minutes. So I think we can conclude there, actually, with our presentation, because we'll be speaking about these in more detail. But do you want to take questions?
I'd be happy to answer questions, certainly.
Yes, Senator Dyson.
Thank you. Please don't think my questions are antagonistic. How did you track the positive outcomes and find out that people, you know, have been out in the workforce now actually were in a child care system as a child?
You might be referring to the national research that's done in places like Minnesota, where they have long-term studies, 20 years or more, where they've watched children who were in very specific programs as early in early childhood, and they've watched them through elementary school, middle school, high school.
So we have none of that data here.
We have nothing like that for Alaska. Right.
When you were doing this stuff for Alaska, or even perhaps for some of these national studies, how did they control to know what positive results came from the participation in these preschool or child care situations as opposed to other positive environmental things in their homes?
Short answer is I can't answer the specifics of the methodology. I think that these are studies that have been generally recognized as fairly credible, and it's certainly very, very difficult to control all the variables that determine how how childhood outcomes or childhood experiences result in adult outcomes. It's a long and in-depth issue, and if I'd be happy to chat with you at some other time, and I can show you some of the research that we found in our we didn't evaluate the quality of the research or really wade into the programs themselves. This was our focus was on, let's do some original research in Alaska on economic impacts, and by the way, let's take a look and see what else has been done in the country that might help us understand what some of the less quantitative impacts might be.
So maybe you spoke to it and I missed it, but so how did you find out concrete terms or objective terms what the positive economic impact in Alaska was from these programs?
Well, I guess depending on if you characterize it as positive or negative, I'll tell you what the impacts are. One is there's the 7,000 jobs. There are 7,400 people in Alaska that are engaged either directly or indirectly in providing these services.
Sure.
So there's employment opportunities there. On the other hand, they're not very high-paying jobs.
No, but the impact as a result of the children's participation, do we have any data on that?
We don't have any data that tells us, for Alaska specifically, that tells us that because of early learning experiences, because of quality early care, that Alaskan children have been more successful in school or we don't have that.
Yeah, and I would assume that many families and parents, we have very involved parents that read to their children and do all kinds of positive things, they could have just as positive results, if not more so, than kids that have been in an out-of-home situation.
I certainly won't argue with that. I agree with that 100%.
Okay, yes. So yeah, what I don't want is for us to falsely assume the kids that don't participate in one of these programs, excellent as it may be, are going into life with a liability or at a disadvantage from all other kids.
Excellent point. In fact, I should point out that much of the national research that we've looked at was focused more on disadvantaged youth.
Sure.
So,
sure.
So that's where they seem to observe some pretty strong positive outcomes over the.
And
over
lastly, if I may continue, on your phone survey, is there a way that you know to discount for just the nature of the subject you brought up? I mean, it would appear to me that not many parents answering your phone survey are going to say that quality child care isn't a high priority. You know, just like when a survey asks, are there any bigots in your family? You know, people tend to say the most positive thing. How do you discount for that?
Well, first of all, we surveyed a random sample of 725 Alaska households, whether they had children or not. So we, in fact, only about one in seven or one in eight households has a child under six in a care setting of some sort. We had to do some subgroup work to really narrow in on that group, but we did our surveys on state funding. Our questioning on state funding priority and so forth was for everyone in the population, whether they had kids or not, from all income demographics, from all geographic demographics, from all racial demographics, et cetera. And so, even still, there's the potential for some self-selection bias. So the tools that we use to further mitigate that is to weight the data so that we make sure that our survey represents a real cross-section of Alaska, not just people with a particular interest in a particular topic.
Last question, if I may.
Yes.
Did you ask comparative questions? So did you ask them, you know, you ask them how important quality child care was, but did you ask them how important that was compared to keeping drugs away from their kids or pornography away from their kids or having really good law enforcement that nailed all the child abusers?
No. Good line of questioning. Would love to do that kind of survey research. Our effort in this case, which again was focused mostly on sort of the economics and what Alaska households are doing now in terms of the kinds of child care services they're receiving, not so much on that
okay.
particular
Thank
line
you.
Of reasoning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Elton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, thanks for the presentation. The slides aren't numbered, but on page 5 of mine, there is a slide that talks about the size of comparable industries in Alaska, and 6,500 child care workers are estimated. Is there any estimate of people who are providing child care services but not being paid, grandparents, aunts, uncles, sisters?
Short answer is no. There's not any good that informal child care. It gets so we wrestled with survey design issues on that particular point a great deal because there's no firm line between when grandma helps with child care and when the sister does, and is there you know, is it just because their money changes hands or what, you know, what is the criteria for determining someone in the labor force? And ultimately our definition was money. Is there some income associated with that job? So there are certainly other siblings taking care of children and the like, but we don't have we can't tell you exactly how many people are engaged in providing some level of care for any amount of time in a particular week or month.
If I could,
you may.
At my age, I don't know perhaps as many people, but you know, I can think of three people here in Juneau that are receiving child care services, but those services aren't being paid for. Am I wrong to suspect that there's a sizable number of children getting child care services that aren't in that 6,500?
Yeah, yes. I think you're safe to say that, yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Well, we certainly thank you for that overview of your study there. And if you don't have any wrap-up at this point, we can just switch over to the second part of it.
Sure, that would be fine. Yeah, thank you, Jim. All right. I'm going to turn this over in just a minute to two of my colleagues, but I'd just like to draw your attention to a document that you received in your packets earlier, which is titled Investing in Alaska's Young Children. And I wanted to point out that this document is an effort on the part of five organizations that are represented here today, including the Alaska Child Care Resource and Referral Network, the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Initiative, Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children, Alaska Head Start Directors Association, and the System for Early Education Development, this document. And this group of people who are all primarily concerned with early care and education and family support in the state have been working together throughout the fall in a collaborative way to come together on some recommendations and background information on early care and education. So this document represents the coordinated effort of those five groups and is endorsed by those groups. The document's divided into three parts, and we'll be addressing all three of them. The first, I think, speaks some to Senator Dyson's questions about supporting families and the importance of recognizing and acknowledging parents as the children's first and best teachers. The second part that we'll be addressing is early care and learning programs and some different key aspects of what makes a quality early care and learning program. Thirdly is the area of Alaska's early childhood system, which we're not really addressing in any detail, but we do ask for consideration of and make a recommendation to have a coordination at the policy level within state of Alaska government on early care and learning issues. So with that, I would like to introduce Abby Hensley, who's the executive director of Ready to Read, Ready to Learn initiative in Alaska, and also Joy Lyon, who's the executive director of the Association for the Education of Young Children for Southeast Alaska.
Can I close this?
Yes.
Brett.
Good afternoon, everybody. Very nice to be here. I once served as staff to this committee, so a long time ago. So it's nice to be back with you all.
Thank you.
Ready to Read, Ready to Learn initiative can best be described as a public-private collaborative effort, providing leadership for Alaska's investment in its youngest citizens, ensuring a best beginning for children and a vital future for Alaska. And we've provided you with a copy of our report and a fact sheet, too, about the initiative. And I'm just going to give you a very brief introduction to this so that you can kind of set this in context as we go forward. Ready to Read, Ready to Learn is co-managed by the Alaska Humanities Forum and United Way of Anchorage. And staff for the initiative is a tangible demonstration of this collaborative effort. I work for the Alaska Humanities Forum, and my colleague, Melinda Myers, is on loan from United Way. And Melinda's in the back. And I'd also like to introduce David White, retired CEO of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, who was a member of the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force and is continuing on as a member of our new board, the Early Learning Council. David? Ready to Read, Ready to Learn began several years ago with a concern about literacy and low reading levels as children moved through school. And as a task force was formed, and you'll see the list of task force members in the report, and began to study the issues, two things came up that were particularly compelling. First, there were those advances in early brain development research, which shed light on the capacity of the young brain in a way that people hadn't really seen before. And second, the economic benefits from investing in the early years, both short-term, typically for children and adults, and long-term for children. And the research just presented to you gives us a look at issues of early care and education we really haven't had before. And it tells us that in addition to the task force members and others who have been associated with Ready to Read, Ready to Learn, the majority of Alaskans, some 87% of them that were surveyed, also value and support early childhood education. I think you'll find that in looking through the report, the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn report, that families really have been at the heart of all this effort. And there's a brief overview of the recommendations on pages 2 and 3 of the report, and they're grouped in three areas. In the home, those recommendations that were intended to help increase early literacy skills, family literacy skills, early learning skills, and parenting skills for all populations in Alaska. And I think that the first of those recommendations is the one that really has struck a note with virtually everybody, and that is to increase the engagement of parents, grandparents, and extended family in their child's learning by providing resources and incentives. And I think, Senator Dyson, that goes to your comments as well about families that are engaged with their children and their children's learning are certainly are certainly doing the best possible for their kids. The second set of recommendations has to do with, before I leave that, I wanted to say, too, that one of the things that we have Ready to Read, Ready to Learn been engaged in is the beginning of a public engagement campaign to help with that engagement of families, all family members, really, in the early learning of their young kids. The second set of recommendations has to do with out of the home in child care and early education programs. And these four recommendations serve to help to increase access to voluntary, affordable, and quality early care and education. And I'll talk more in a minute about some of the things that we've done in that area. And the third, which is called looking ahead in the report, but really has to do with sustainability, is that these recommendations establish a sustainable early childhood literacy and learning system with accountability for outcomes. And there are four recommendations in that section. So I just wanted you to be sure that you had that. Support for what you hear today from my colleagues can be found in one or more of all of these recommendations. And support can be found for the strengthening families model that you will hear more about later this week. In the investing in children piece that Carol mentioned on the second page about some of the recommendations for supporting families, in addition to the three Ready to Read, Ready to Learn recommendations for in the home, there's also another one. And I just wanted to point that out to you as well. It's encourage all early care and education programs to have a family support component with strategies to foster child development. So we really, all of us, are very much interested in making sure that families have what they feel that they need to make sure that they can raise their children in a way that that their kids end up being successful in when they enter kindergarten through school and beyond. Last year, you and your colleagues appropriated $250,000 to further the work of Ready to Read, Ready to Learn, and the fact sheet that you have in front of you, too, lists some of the work that we've undertaken, with $167,000 of that $250,000 and support from the private sector. Well, currently, the governor's budget includes $1.5 million in the Department of Education and Early Development for Ready to Read, Ready to Learn recommendations, and I want to be sure that you know that it's support for the recommendations, not necessarily that those recommendations, that the work would all be carried out by us, by Melinda and me, that is. We met with Commissioner Sampson this morning, and we are supporting this funding request. I think, again, it's important to note the public-private collaborative nature of this effort, that it really isn't just government, it really isn't just the private sector, but all of us working together. And in that request, some of the work that we anticipate would get accomplished includes work on the early learning guidelines that you may have heard about before that were developed with the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education and Early Development, and then endorsed by the State Board of Education. And the early learning guidelines really lay out for us what we Alaskans think that children from 0 to 5 ought to know, understand, and be able to do. Some of that last year's $250,000 went toward pulling together those guidelines and getting them printed and distributed. But we also know that for parents to be able to use this kind of information, it needs to be provided in different ways than just a thick document. And so we would hope that some of the money that you would appropriate this year would be to help to translate that document into languages other than English, to chunk it out into ways that would be more usable for parents. So it's in a variety of formats. And also to develop and then to deliver some workshops to help people use those early learning guidelines, because they really should be the foundation for all of our early childhood work. We also want to hold community conversations around the state to work on developing a system of early education in Alaska that takes into account all the different needs and desires of families in the state, but that it's a system so that it's not so disparate. And that, too, builds on work that we have already undertaken. And then we also, in that, we would hope what we anticipate, too, is continuing support for the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Early Learning Council and administration of our office. The final part of what we hope that money would go for includes a quality rating system, or implementing a quality rating system for childcare and early learning programs. And just briefly, the goal of a quality rating system is to create a sustainable system, not just a rating scale, to support early care and education programs as they move toward higher quality. A QRS also provides methods for parents to evaluate programs and make better informed choices for their children. It increases access to quality programs, thus improving the outcomes for all the children it serves. And a quality rating system evaluates criteria such as ratio of staff to children, family involvement, physical environments, and the skill and education of the staff. And with last year's funding, the Department of Health and Social Services contracted with Ready to Read, Ready to Learn for the design of a QRS for Alaska, along with the budget and plan for phased-in implementation. And funding for FY08 would build on that and begin a phased-in implementation. Now, why that makes a difference? I found a quote in the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Plan the whole document, not just the executive summary that you may have had, that I thought really puts this part of the work into focus. And the quote is, "Compared to children in lower quality child care and early education programs, children in higher quality programs have more advanced language and pre-math skills, more advanced social skills, and warmer relationships with their teachers. Elements of quality include well-trained and well-compensated teachers, language-rich classroom environments, small group sizes, low staff child rates, low staff turnover rates, and practices that involve and support parents." And that, to me, put this really into context. I'd like to, before my colleague Joy Lyon talks more about a quality rating system and what it can and how it has worked in other parts of the country, I also wanted to say that, back for just a minute to the notion of parents as a child's first and best teacher, one of the things that we felt very strongly about, and frankly and still do, is helping parents, especially young parents, to know the kinds of simple, quick, cheap things that they can do that really can make a difference in their kids' early learning. For example, it's been said that children who are spoken to more, who are played with more, who parents sing with them, talk with them, read with them, all those kinds of things that we know are important, how we can help parents and the rest of our community really make that kind of thing a social imperative, so that early paying attention to young children and their learning, their early learning, really becomes the kind of everyday thing that fastening a seatbelt is, those kinds of things that we do now just automatically without thinking, that even 10 years ago people were having to be nudged and urged and cajoled to do. So we really think that this focus on young children, particularly on their early learning and literacy skills, should really be that kind of social imperative that all of us pay attention to. And so a quality rating system will go, I think, a long way in making that happen. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joy Lyon, the director of the Association for the Education of Young Children in Southeast Alaska. And we're also a grantee for the Department of Health and Social Services in delivering the Resource and Referral Program in Southeast as part of the Alaska Child Care Resource and Referral Network, their colleagues in Anchorage and Fairbanks, Child Care Connection and CARES. And our mission is to increase the access of parents to early learning programs, in particular parents that are working parents, and also to increase the quality of the programs and the capacity of programs in the state. So as Abby mentioned, capacity is one thing, but it's not just an empty seat on the plane, you know, that you say, oh, there's an opening in a program. Really, there's a lot of decision-making for parents along the way, that a lot of parents are coming in and they're not really familiar with what to look for in what is a high-quality program. We offer a referral service to parents who call us. You know, they have a job starting on Monday, and they need a program, and they need it now in order to be able to get to their new job. And so we guide them in the questions to ask and what to look for and listen for. But at the end of the conversation, they tend to say, well, which one do you think is the best? Or what would you recommend? And we have to say, well, we can't give you our personal recommendation, because it's really up to you as the parent to find the program that's going to be the best match for you and your child. So parents are really looking for more information, something that they can more quickly and better make those really important decisions. Because what we hate for it to see is to see them back again in two to 4 weeks saying, that program didn't work out, now I've got to take a day off work and find another program. So the more upfront work that they do, the better off for the child to have a stable program and for their job. So the quality rating system is something, 14 other states have a statewide quality rating system now. And we have much to learn from their efforts and their evaluation of the programs. They are what's coming out of many of the evaluations of those programs, which are still in the early stages, are that the teacher qualifications are one of the most important indicators of quality. That when they go it through and they rate the programs, and we have national rating tools, you know, it's a challenge to rate quality. You know, it's easier to measure quantity, of course. But there are national tools now. The Frank Porter Graham organization came and gave a training last year so that we had inter-rater reliability in our assessment of programs, and able to use these national tools now to measure the quality of the programs and see, get a baseline of where we are. So last year, this time, we launched a quality enrichment project, which is the quality of first test or a first pilot of a quality rating system, in that we provided assessments of programs, 120 classrooms throughout the state, and provided the supports. It's not just the rating of the programs, but it's also bringing the supports and incentives and quality enrichment, equipment grants, teacher education, to lift the quality of the program, and then do an assessment at the end of the project or annually to be able to measure the difference. And I think that's really important to know, that when you invest in early childhood, you can get a measurable outcome. And I appreciate your questions on that, Senator Dyson, that this quality rating system is a way that you can really measure exactly the quality improvements that, you know, from the investment in the system. So that's also helps the parents, coming back to the parents, that, you know, when you have a star rating system for hotel or restaurants, you feel a little bit better about what you're paying for and what kind of decision you're making. And then you can also learn about what it is, you know, that's another learning tool for parents, is to see, well, what are the components of a quality program? That it's about the learning environment, the family partnerships, the training and education of the staff, the child-adult ratios. Those are all for the key components of a quality rating system. So we have, you know, I think that's a critical piece to have in place, is that ability to measure the quality of the programs as we're bringing in additional supplements and supports to the teachers to be able to increase their education and professional development, as that is being seen as the leading indicator in the measuring the correlation between high quality programs, or programs where teachers have credentials and degrees in the field. So the other states are pretty consistent in that finding. And also, I've lost my train of thought, but I'm sure it was going somewhere. But do you have a question, Senator Dyson?
I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand, but we're gonna limit the questions. I'm gonna let you ask your question, not having a problem with that, but we're running slow on time, and I know there are other people that need to present.
Yeah, thank you. And I was trying to wait to not break into your train of thought. Two kind of related questions. One is that the rating system kind of assumes that some or many parents are not capable of doing the analysis themselves. And on some level, I can see that looking at building safety codes and really knowing what's going on with the kids, it's pretty subtle sometimes. They said, you know, I don't think the state needs to decide who can be a beauty parlor operator or a barber. I think people are capable of making those decisions. But we've decided that many government-offered services have to have some kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval. But where it really starts to concern me is that sounds like a wonderful big city, urban, suburban sort of thing. How do you translate that to Western Alaska, where I've worked? And there's a tradition of almost the grandparents kind of raising the very young children. And it's a very, very warm and nurturing environment where the clan and family traditions and a whole bunch of things are really exported to the children, you know, with storytelling and sort of things. And I just have trouble seeing how your rating system could be adapted or even make sense. And maybe the very best child care providers, these grandmothers with a great deal of wisdom, wouldn't rate any points on your system. Comment?
Well, that is a good point, and that's something else that these 14 states that have gone ahead of us have found, that there's a real difference in the way that urban versus rural communities utilize the quality rating system. And you're right that the natural network of friends and neighbors and kin of relatives is very important, and in no way do we want to disrupt, you know, what's working in that regard. And in no way are we wanting to, you know, encourage more parents to be in the workforce if they don't want to be in the workforce. I think it'd be great if we had more tax credits for parents to be able to stay home for their first, especially those first couple of years. But parents that are in the field, that are working, I mean, in the McDowell study showed that the rural communities are having even more difficult time, that is preventing them, those 36% that are unable to, or they're limited by in their ability to work. The rural communities stated that access was the priority, or the leading reason why they were limited in their ability to work was the access to care. So it does seem that the rural communities are saying that it's not enough. Sometimes their natural support networks, maybe they're working also, or there might be some background issues or family dynamics that are not working out for them. So in any time that we're able to support people, you know, caring for their own children and their own grandchildren, I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to support that. So.
Yes. One quick thing.
Yes.
Too. And Senator Dyson, I think, I'm not sure that we mentioned that this system would be voluntary.
that's how we would want to do it in our state. We gathered together a group of people from across the state in late January to meet with one of the consultants who's actually designing the quality rating system for Alaska. And it seemed like the consensus was pretty much that this should be a voluntary kind of thing. So certainly not a governmental mandate.
And not related to funding streams.
I don't know the answer to that question.
As in, you wouldn't get your funding if you didn't have the rating?
Oh, no.
Okay, thank you. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. You may continue.
I'm going to go ahead and let Debbie and Annie introduce themselves while I boot up their PowerPoint.
Okay, that's fine. While they're doing that, are there any questions or comments from the committee?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Debbie Baldwin. I'm the Child Development Division Director at Rural Alaska Community Action Program. We serve over 1,300 families with young children in three early childhood models, Head Start, the Parents as Teachers Program, and we have a child care center in Anchorage. We're in over 24 communities with our Head Start and Early Head Start program, predominantly located in rural Alaska. And I'll let my colleague introduce herself.
Good afternoon. My name is Ann Shade. I'm president of the Alaska Head Start Association. I'm also the director at Bristol Bay Native Association out in the Bristol Bay. We serve 97 kids in five communities in a very rural area.
Before we begin, I'd also like to recognize and thank some of the participants in the audience. We have some Head Start parents, grandparents, and other Head Start staff members who joined us this afternoon to listen to this important discussion going on. Hopefully, your office will be receiving a few visitors from the Head Start program. We have a Head Start Leadership Conference happening down at Centennial Hall for the next 3 days, and we're encouraging many of your constituents to come in and say hello to you and tell the story of Head Start. We have a short PowerPoint presentation for you. I think you've been provided two documents from us, a copy of this PowerPoint presentation and also a Head Start fact sheet.
Head Start's currently serving over 3,600 children throughout the state of Alaska. Of those kids, these are the poorest of the poor, and at least 60% of those children are Alaska Native. Head Start has 17 grantees and serves kids in all corners of the state. The mission of Head Start is that Head Start is a national program targeted at the most at-risk families with young children. Head Start promotes social readiness by enhancing the social and cognitive development of children through the provision of educational, health, nutritional, social, and other services to the enrolled children and families. Head Start serves children through several different models. There's Early Head Start, which serves kids 0 to 3 as well as prenatal. There's Regular Head Start, which serves families and children of ages 3 and 4 and until they enter kindergarten. And then there's a delivery model called a combination program, which is sort of a combination of both of those. They do some classroom activities, but they also do a lot of home-based activities. Currently, as I mentioned before, there's about 3,600 children being served throughout the state in 109 communities. There's 927 staff members, which if this were a business would be in the top 20% of employers in the state. We also have a steadily increasing number of volunteers that seems to be going up every year rapidly. Current estimates show that there are at least 12 to 15,000 children unserved in at least 102 communities. These are kids that are just income eligible for Head Start. We suspect that there's actually more than that because some of the more rural programs actually have some different eligibility requirements, which would allow even more children to be eligible. Currently, throughout the state, there are at least 800 children on a wait list.
Thank you, Annie. What makes Head Start unique? There are a lot of other early learning, early care, early learning programs out on the horizon, and we thought we'd spend a little bit of time of telling you why we think we do things very well with families with young children. Head Start has 42 years of experience. Again, the Head Start program was started in 1965 as part of the War on Poverty, and we have been providing high-quality early care and learning programs across the nation for 42 years. We have a set of 1,800 to 2,000 performance standards that are applied across the board to all programs nationally. Talks about environments, quality environments, teacher credentialing, child outcomes, school readiness, health services, medical services. We also have congressionally mandated outcomes, early learning outcomes in 13 key indicators of school readiness. So our national government has already told us what children need to know prior to heading into kindergarten, and we've been sharing those successes again for several years on the outcome reports. We are a wraparound program. We believe in comprehensive services. When you are serving families who have children that are at risk, education is not the only thing that is a priority in their life. We have health, medical, dental services, mental health services, family partnership, parenting knowledge. We have, again, a program that believes that basic needs need to be met so that you can engage with the family in understanding the importance of education. We meet the parents where they're at culturally. We, again, have several Alaska Native cultures throughout our state. We are becoming a state with rapidly increasing populations internationally. And so we provide it in the cultural context of the family. I think probably one of the most well-known indicators of our success in Head Start is what we do with families and parents. We have a parent training program, and we also believe strongly in empowering the parents, just as Senator Dyson spoke to eloquently before. We also believe in shared governance, that education is a responsibility of the parents, as well as the institution providing education. Parents participate on our policy council and through shared governance make decisions about how we spend our resources and what goals we work on with our programs. This slide represents one of the things we're going to talk with you about in a few minutes about the challenge with Head Start. We have federal and state funds. Our state funds comprise about 23% of the total funds spent in our state on Head Start services. This shows funding stream over the last 3 years, and in general, the federal government is providing about $27.5 billion to support our 3,600 children and families in the state, and our state is at this point providing about $6.3 million. I put this chart in here basically because if you read nothing else, you could see that our funding has been very flatlined over the past 3 years. And in FY06 last year, the Head Start programs across the nation took a 1% federal cut. And so we are actually working on less money this year from the federal government than we had in previous years. What are some of the outcomes of services in the state of Alaska over the past year? And again, I just picked a couple of them to share with you today. Out of our 3,600 children that we serve, 3,319 families have identified a medical home, an ongoing source of medical and dental care. 2,833 children received dental screenings last year. That is no easy feat when a majority of our programs are based in rural Alaska. And we have provider issues. We do not have enough providers to provide those kinds of services. So this speaks to the tremendous collaboration Head Start has with our medical and dental providers. Of the 3,600 children that we serve, roughly about 728 are English language learners. And they are learning English prior to entering kindergarten. Again, through Head Start services, they participate in language enrichment activities. 113 children received a mental health assessment. All children receive support for behavioral health development, but of the 3,600 children, 113 were identified as needing further mental health assessment. 79 of those children were referred to providers, and 42 received ongoing mental health support. And we're talking children 0 to 5. Additional outcomes we saw last year, we have over 400 children with special needs currently receiving services in the Head Start program, but I think what is significant is over 200 of them were identified while receiving services from Head Start. They were not previously identified as children with special needs. And again, the sooner we can provide supportive services, either through infant learning or the special head services, the I think more successful chance they will have once they get to the next educational institution. The largest Head Start program, which is the program I represent, Rural Alaska Community Action Program, on the 13 indicators of school readiness that Congress has mandated that we track, we have documentation and data that shows we have anywhere from a 16% to 48% learning gain in our four-year-olds going to kindergarten. I'm sure any of the other 16 grantees across the state could share with you similar successful information about preparing children for kindergarten. Our statistics show that we have a twofold increase in the number of teachers achieving associate degrees in early childhood. And some of the background information I provided you in the fact sheet says that the 1998 Head Start Act mandated that 50% of the teachers across the nation serving in Head Start programs receive an AA degree in early childhood by the year 2005. And so we have doubled our amount of teachers in the state of Alaska who now possess early associate degrees in early childhood. Some of our challenges. Flatline funding. The 1% reduction in federal funds last year actually equated to about 11% inflation-adjusted decrease in purchasing power. Since we have been flatlined for so many years from our federal and state source, and the cost of living and the cost of providing services, particularly in rural Alaska, have escalated, we have about 11% less money to provide the same level of services than we had before. A survey in the state of Alaska shows that of the 17 programs providing Head Start services here, we have reduced services, totally eliminated services to 361 children. Many of these children are in rural Alaska. Six communities have closed Head Start services completely. Some of those communities are Norvik, St. Mary's, Seward, and I believe in the fact sheet I might have provided you a list of the other communities. Annie just shared with the other Head Start directors this week that she closed services last week in Manakota. And again, it's just extremely tight times to deliver the same amount of services with less money. One of the ways that we have been able to stay and providing services in other communities is through adopting probably what is a more economical model of services. It is much more economical for us to deliver home-based services than it is center-based services. And center-based services are classroom services. Community assessments show that communities want center-based programs. They want classroom. They want group time. They want combined learning time for their 3 and 4 year olds in the community. But it cost about $200,000 to run a classroom of 20 children for a year. And in the home-based model, again, you provide a weekly home visit for an hour and a half, two group socials a month, and that is much less resources that are needed to provide that program option. We don't want to provide home-based services to families that don't want it. But again, it's one way to stay in communities as our funding sources are becoming very tight. Annie spoke earlier about the number of underserved children in the state. In our communities that we are in right now, we have 800 children on the wait list. It is our guess that those 800 children will not receive Head Start services before they enter kindergarten.
The larger number is the number of unserved communities and unserved children across the state that do not have any access to Head Start services in their community. And in, as Annie spoke, I believe the conservative estimate is about 12,000 to 15,000 children who are income eligible to receive Head Start services but have no access to them. And thank you very much for making a difference in the lives of children here in the state and families with young children. The fact that you invited Head Start to be a part of the dialogue and discussion today, we are so appreciative of. As I said, we have 42 years of providing high-quality early learning experiences for children across the nation of all different linguistic and cultural backgrounds, and we are just pleased that through the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn initiative that they have invited Head Start to the table to be a part of the future dialogue.
Thank you so much. I do have one question. Yeah. Is there a certain amount of money that you requested in this year's budget for Head Start? State funded.
We have been informed that our state appropriation will be flat again this year. But I know if you're asking me what it is that we need.
Yes.
We actually have produced a critical issues document that asks for a 10% increase.
Okay, we won't discuss it, but I'd like to have that before you leave.
I would be happy to share that with you. Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Are your, I assume the teachers, but are the attendants mandatory reporters?
Yes, child abuse and neglect reporters.
Yeah.
That is correct.
And are you getting them the materials and the training that they need to know?
Yes.
To do that job?
The Head Start performance standards require that we provide annual training on child abuse and neglect reporting, and that we train our staff to recognize they are mandated reporters.
Good. And Mansager did an excellent job of getting a great DVD out on that last year, and I would commend it to you.
Thank you very much.
And you probably don't have any records of how many abuse cases have been reported by the network around the state, do you?
I'm not familiar from the Head Start perspective. Perhaps OCS might be able to tell us from the receiving end of where the initial reports came from.
Yeah, they and the troopers. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Thank you again for your time.
Yeah, we're glad to have you, and thanks for the report.
We have one more.
Is it going to be a short presentation? We'd like to hear it. Yes, come on. We got about 5 minutes.
Hello, my name is Tiffany Ryan. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children. We're a membership association statewide, and currently have just over 900 members. And our mission is to lead, facilitate, and support the efforts of early childhood educators so that every child has access to quality education. I know I just have a few minutes, so I'm going to provide a summarized version. You all have in front of you, hopefully, documents on quality childcare and professional development, as well as quality childcare and compensation. I'm going to be going over those very quickly. The first one that I'm going to be talking about is professional development. You've heard about the systems that need to be in place in order to make up a quality early education environment in Alaska from the previous presenters. And I want to talk about two items that are essential to the successful implementation of such a system. In order for early educators to successfully increase the quality of care that they're able to provide in accordance with any proposed QRS system as well, they need to have professional development opportunities. So in the handout, and as you've heard previously, research clearly indicates that early learners have better outcomes with adequately prepared teachers. Debbie also mentioned the Head Start mandate of 50% of the lead teachers having an AA degree or better. SEED, which Carol represents, implemented a scholarship program with federal monies to help with that mandate, and that's how the percentage has doubled, more than doubled, to provide these educators with increased professional development. Unfortunately, SEED's funding is ending this fall, and so those services will no longer be provided. Mm. In addition, there's a proposed federal mandate currently that standard be raised to a BA in early childhood education for Head Start. So it looks like down the pike there are going to be even further requirements because they recognize that that it is an indicator of high quality, increased professional development. And I want to make sure that we say that we're talking about Head Start because they do have these mandates. However, they represent a very small fraction of early childhood educators in the state. Home providers, center-based preschools, all need these services as well and currently are not receiving them. So if we continue to provide the professional development that SEED has been able to do, I believe we can break the standards, break the cycle of low standards, low wages, and low quality that we have in the current system. And so what we're proposing is funding to continue this professional development scholarship system. As you can imagine, it's difficult for these folks who are working full-time and making around $20,000 a year to afford to go back to school and attain this education, so the scholarship programs are crucial. You have in front of you, you see the cost breakout. Let me know if you have any questions on that. Those numbers are based on the remainder of Head Start employees that need to reach the federal mandate. So that would get us up to our 50% that is needed. Very quickly, I'm going to move on to the compensation piece, hopefully fit it in about 1 minute. Our turnover rate in Alaska is 44%, which is very, very high. And you heard earlier that turnover is a key indicator of quality or lack of turnover, that is. And in order for early educators to have an incentive to increase their professional development, they need to have fair wages. And also to be able to retain them in the field. SEED also had a system, the Roots Awards, retaining our outstanding teaching staff, which again, the funding is gone away. But that is a system, and there are many other systems similar to that in other states that provide stipends to early educators to help retain them in the field. And again, we're recommending funding for that. It's shown with other states that could reduce our turnover rate to between 12 and 17% from 44%, which is a pretty dramatic number. And again, these work kind of hand in hand, the professional development and the compensation pieces. SEED has developed a child care registry, which has a professional development ladder. And the stipends for compensation would be based on that ladder. So it provides the incentive for increased education as well. They know they're going to move up professional development-wise. They will get an increased stipend as well. I have the cost there. If you have questions, please let me know. And just for your information, the registry has already been developed, is funded, and that is a crucial piece of a compensation program. And in addition, the infrastructure for the implementation of both the professional development scholarship program and the compensation programs have already been implemented and developed, so the infrastructure is there. I think I got it in. Well,
that's quite all right. I'm glad that you were able to present to us, but you're going to be here for the next 3 days, right?
I leave tomorrow night.
Oh, you leave tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. I would like to have some additional time to speak with you at a later time.
Okay, great.
Because some of the things that you've mentioned, I'm not even aware of.
Okay.
That you're even doing them. So I do need further information, and I will share it with the entire committee.
I would be happy.
Try to bring us up to speed exactly where we are on these issues.
Okay, wonderful. I'd be happy to.
All right.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for coming and presenting today. I know that it was a rush job, but the information is very valuable. And some of us may be able to hear you again on the House side tomorrow. And thank you for coming. And feel free to call on our offices.
Yeah, I yes. Just like to, you know, we acquired from the city of Juneau. In fact, they gave it to us, this Masonic temple next door. And we're putting a child care. I'm chair Ledge Council, and we're working on, I think, about 16, for 16 kids right next door. If I can get the other senators to agree with me. But we're going to have a meeting here shortly. I think we can get it through, I hope, anyway.
All right. Did I miss someone that was supposed to testify?
No.
All right, thank you. We'll adjourn at this time, then.
Are you on the ledge?